Egg session number 12097, reel 3.
Well, when the snorkel suddenly arrived on the scene, whereby the submarine just had to push this tube up, but this time we had the 3-centimeter radar, which was much more efficient than the old one we'd had in the early days, but even that could only pick up the snort at a few miles, as opposed to, and it was a very dubious contract, especially in rough weather. Now, the problem became very, very much more difficult. But of course, also by this time, we had far more resources out in the Atlantic. And I think on one occasion, before the war ended, they actually had 40 swordfish flying from the decks of the merchant ships in a convoy. And we were working part of the time in the Clyde, because the snorkel submarines were actually getting into there, because they were so much less vulnerable, not having to surface. In fact, actually put the aircraft ashore to Stornoway for some reason. Got there, and we'd rush them all ashore and then told to get them back on board again. And then finally in Vindex, the D-Day landings started, and we were sitting out in the Atlantic. It's an anti-submarine screen for any submarines coming from the Atlantic into the channel. Can't remember whether we detected any of that time or not. And then that was the end of the Windex.
What could you do against the snorkel then? Anything at all?
Well, if you picked it up and you were quick enough, you could get an attack in. The great thing, having spotted it, what you then needed was to get the ships in with their Aztec, con the ships onto it.
How much success were you having in the Vindex?
Well, again, it's very difficult to assess. We got quite a lot of attacks in on submarines, but the depth charges we were using were not... You had to be very lucky to get a kill. But you damage them enough for them to go home, probably. Or alternatively, of course, if you were working ahead of a convoy, as we sometimes were, not the carrier, but the aircraft, you keep the submarines down and the convoy get past them, which was, again, was the aim. But it didn't...
Sorry.
The thing one had to get in people's minds about anti-submarine warfare, if the Germans had thousands of submarines operating in the Atlantic and didn't sink a single ship from one of our convoys, it wasn't the number of submarines or the number of submarines who killed that matter. It was the safe and timely arrival of the convoy. And it was very hard to get that over to some people. They go spend hours hunting a damaged submarine and let the convoy take his charge and take his chance. Yes, we did a Russian convoy too. It was one of the daylight ones. We had strikers there to another escort carrier. At the time, we took the old Royal Sovereign and collected the old four-stack American destroyers up to the Russians.
How different was that from the Atlantic convoys?
It's pretty hectic because there's a lot of air attack, which didn't particularly worry the swordfish. We were out doing anti-submarine work. A lot of submarines around too. You got quite a lot of attacks in, I think. Lost one of the escorts. I think it was about all there. A very amusing time in Russia.
Did you go ashore in Russia?
Yes. They sent a most marvellous concert party on board. And we thought it was going to be pretty dreary, but in fact it was an absolute riot. And magnificent, they were from their great academy of music. But they just sang and played delightful stuff, and the sailors were absolutely sort of rocking, but after, and really loved it. Very cleverly done.
So this was aboard the Vindex?
Yeah. Yes, in the hangar. And it was interesting, afterwards we had them down the wardroom, and they were terribly careful. There's this grey little man watching them all the time. We managed to Mickey Flynn him, actually. He was pretty well unconscious when we got towards the end of the party.
Was this at Murmansk?
Yeah.
What did you see ashore at Murmansk when you went?
Oh, nothing really. Just went for a walk. And well, of course, a lot of rather dull country. It's nice to get ashore and get a bit of exercise. I think we're probably fairly restricted in where we could go.
What did you do after the Vindex? You were at the School of Naval Air Warfare?
Oh, yes, 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 that's right. I mean, towards about that, in my last couple of months in Vindex, we kept getting letters and signals saying I was to leave it and go and start a school to train the future commanding officers and senior pilots to fight the war in the Pacific in Barracudas or Avengers. And I got my captain, Bill Bayliss, who was a great guy, to write back saying that he agreed with me that it was not a very suitable point, and as I'd never been to the Pacific, I'd never flown an Avenger, I'd never flown a Barracuda, and they ought to think of somebody else. And finally, the date drew near, and we got a very curt signal from the airplane saying that the course was to start in 14 days, and it was about time. And my observer would be Lieutenant Commander Haynes, a charming Australian. About time I met him and decided where we were going to do it. So I grabbed a Barracuda and Digger Haynes, and we just flew around the country looking at various bases. Didn't like any of them much, and finally landed at St. Merritt. There was the fighter school training the people for the Pacific War, and alongside, part of it was a group of about a dozen aircraft, Avengers and Barracudas, which was training the observers and air gunners to avoid fighter attack. Well, it's so obvious, we just said, right, settle in here. They didn't decide we were going to tell the Admiral what we were going to do, because they seemed rather anxious about it. And the night before, Digger and I talked it over, and a bloke called Jimmy Gardner, who was part of Yardley's organisation, splendid chap, brilliant, absolutely brilliant pilot. He'd flown before the war, the aircraft and else. He was running the fighter part of it. I think by this time, I've been an acting lieutenant commander quite a long time. Anyhow, it was a lieutenant commander, right? You had a job to run the squadron, which was sitting there with all these suitable aircraft. So I went up the Aberdeen, persuading the logical thing to do is to make Jimmy an acting commander, put in command of the whole unit, and we called it the School of Naval Air Warfare, and I would serve under him as the CEO of the Barracuda and Avenger. And so that was how I was there for 6 months, training these blokes, and of course was also flying all the fighter aircraft myself to come in and do the attacks, so that I could personally criticise the way they were evading, because they'd reckoned that the guns carried in the back of those aircraft were pretty useless against a fighter, and far better to have them doing clever evasion. So just as the fighter came in open fire, they do some strange manoeuvre. And then we had VE Day, and the Admiral Harcourt had taken over the light fleet carriers, who were taking them out to the Pacific, and he said he wanted a chap serving his staff who would help plan the operation and then fly on it with all the aircraft from the three or four carriers, whatever he had at the time, and thus profit by his mistakes and hopefully not repeat them. And the Admiral had picked somebody who was generally felt hadn't got the background. I obviously had. I'd been training these CEOs. I'd been flying all the types of fighters in all the latest types of tactics. So, pierhead jump. My wife sewed a bit of gold on the front of my cap, and about 2 days later I was on my way out to the Pacific. And we paused at Sri Lanka, and India had all squadrons ashore there working up and I think changing aircraft or something too. And then on to Australia, and we were just about set to go up on our first run when they dropped the bomb.
So you didn't get into action then?
No.
Could I ask you about a post-war piece of work that you did in connection with Korea? Because I think that you were doing some work at the Admiralty appointing Fleet Air Arm aircrew to go out there.
Yeah. Well, actually, I know after the... We actually went up and took over Hong Kong, which was rather exciting.
To the liberation of Hong Kong?
The liberation of Hong Kong, yes.
Could you describe that?
Well, we, on the way up, it was fascinating because there was a terrific argument going on, signals flying everywhere, and being on the staff, I was seeing them all, of course. And the Americans were desperate to get to take Hong Kong. They had their ships get on the way there. And there's a finally, after the signals flying all over the place, this must be known now, I think there's a marvellous signal to Harcourt from Bevin, who was then Foreign Secretary, take Hong Kong. Just that. Finish the whole thing. And about 100 or so miles, we did not know what had happened, whether the Japanese surrendered or whether they were still fully equipped. And I went in with a couple of fighter squadrons. And in case the things were suitable, I had a lot of these message bags with a tail on you could drop. It's perfectly obvious that nothing was happening. The airfield had no actually two or three derelict aircraft on it. Nothing was happening at all. And we dropped all these message bags, and then the prisoner war. The Japanese had been very good. They'd let all the prisoners out and were helping them, really. And then the next day, the fleet went in, and I was stuffed ashore trying to keep some sort of order in Kowloon. A few weeks.
How did you do that?
Well, the Japanese were absolutely first class. They said, look, we will patrol the streets, because the Chinese are just bent on looting as soon as they could. We will patrol the streets, but we want one sailor, one British sailor, with each patrol. And he stands there, so it's them doing it. And it worked marvellously.
So was there any looting?
Well, there was a bit, yes, but not a lot. We used to send patrols through, high-speed patrols going through and shoot over the heads of a few people now and then, break a few windows. We didn't do any harm to anybody, but it frightened them back into the houses again. Because the place is pretty badly bent. And the two vital things I had was to get the oxygen plant going, Foreign Oxygen Company, so we could get the oxygen for the acetylene cutting to cut away girders and things across the street and get some of the wrecks up, and to get the Castle Peak Brewery going, because the sailors had no beer, and this was a disaster. And I think after 3 weeks, and the other problem we then found was a terrific amount of piracy going on, because all the junks wanted to bring food in. And so I then had the job of, I went to Harcourt and said, I can't finish my job. Kowloon, what do you want me to do? He said, well, for God's sake, stop the piracy. So that was my last few months. It was very interesting.
How did the pirates operate?
They would just stop a junk. They've got some arms galore lying around, all the Japanese arms, British pre-war arms, a lot they could pick up. And just take it, probably either kill or chuck the crew overboard, take it into one of the ports, flog all the cargo, and either go out in that junk or another one, do the same thing again. And we stopped it by just putting armed parties, which would go to sea in a junk, stop another one at sea, step into that. So they never knew when they were going to... We weren't particularly kind to them as they did open fire on us. They got... Everything was coming to them. And that...
Did the Chinese seem to be glad to be liberated?
Oh, yes. Yes, they did. Apart from us, food had been very scarce. But again, McNamara, who's the... came out as a civilian governor for the last several months, if not year or so. He was absolutely first class. It was interesting, all the prisoner of war, they came out of the camp and said, look, please be good to him, he's been marvellous to us. He insisted on putting all the prisoners on the same food as his own troops. Charming man.
What was his name?
McNamara. And when he was finally leaving, I regret to say our own troops, anyone who had anything with him, they were liable to lift off him. And he had a gold hunter watch, which his father had acquired, and I think his father or grandfather had acquired in London when he was Japanese ambassador. And he gave it to me, and 6 months later I managed to get it back to him. I'd be glad of, because, as I say, he undoubtedly had been extraordinarily good to our people.
Now, if I can ask you again the question I asked you about Korea, about the
way... Well, that was... I was put into the Second Sea Lord's office literally just as the Korean War started. And all I had to do was to get the air crew out there. And of course, we were desperately short. We brought some New Zealanders back. That's a scheme that worked very well. Any New Zealand pilot or observer who'd been in the fleet island during the war, we offered him, see, a lot of them had married English girls while they were over here, that they would like to come back with their family. We'd pay their fare back, and then the end of the Korean War, we ship them all back again. Or the families could go back early if they liked. But it was a free passage to the families to come to England. So all these girls who hadn't seen their parents for a good many years came over with the grandchildren, which was a splendid idea. We got 40 damn good blokes back that way. The only trouble was because they were fairly out of training with the types of aircraft we wanted. And they were hopping mad, but I put them into the second line jobs to relieve the fellows I wanted to send to Korea. It didn't suit them at all. However, it was a very good way of getting them. But it was a difficult job because you normally work on a 9% drafting margin. And I think we got down to 3.5-4 at one time. And some poor chap come back after a very tough spell of operations out there. And give him a weekend leave, and he was back to his next job. But, not out there, but somewhere ashore, somewhere in England. And the interesting thing there was, it never occurred to me not to fly the people out and back. So I duly, some girl in the office said, "Well, you have to do that." I said, "What the hell are they to get the man out there? Fix a passage." That's what one does in shape like this. And sent signals out, arranging the other blow to get back. In a lovely moment, I got a yellow jacket, which is the sort of immediate you had to deal with at once, on my desk, saying, to be noted by the Treasury, that Carter Dick be authorising flights to and from Korea without first getting Treasury approval on each occasion. Why? So I took it home with it. Julia wrote a minute on it. I wasn't entitled and should have gone through my boss. See, and I calculated that had I done so, I would need to recall to the service 42 lieutenants and 17 lieutenant commanders at the cost of a living approximately there, and I had apparently about saved them a substantial amount of money by using air passage. I also noted the NAFI for the last 3 years in sending all their people to and fro by air, who presumably did it because it was cheaper, shot it in the outro. Phone rang. The pompous gentleman said, "Commander Duke, I'm speaking to the Treasury. Would you care to come to lunch a bit, White?" And I walked in, and he was standing with his yellow jack in his hand, shook hands, tore it in half, chucked it in the fire, and said, "Why the hell didn't somebody tell me this before?" Unbelievable, isn't it? I'm not sure that ought to go on the record, right?